Welcome back. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And earlier this month, I had the opportunity to talk with a group that's not always heard from during the debates about school testing, our students. A group of Montgomery County high school students joined me at the 2015 Education Policy Forum convened in Annapolis by the Maryland State Education Association. Here's that conversation. Let me introduce who's here. Next to me is Anders Alil, who is a senior in the IB program at Richard Montgomery High School and one of the founding members of the Minority Scholars Program. Next to him, Nicholas Bayon, who is from La Paz, Bolivia, and he's a senior at Walter Johnson High School. Melissa Escobar is next to him. She's a senior at Richard Montgomery High School, where she was also one of the founders of the school's Minority Scholars Program. Ariana Jones is a senior at Clarksburg High School, and she's also part of since ninth grade, of the Minority Scholars Program. And Angie Seliyama is next to her, and she's a senior at Clarksburg High School and has been part of the same program, Scholars Program, since the ninth grade. And good to have you all on this panel. So I want to start by asking you all your thoughts about testing, but since the results of PARC came out. And we talked last time together when we had this conversation about how the stress of testing, which we'll get to in a bit, but I really want to get your thoughts on what were your reactions when you saw how how Montgomery County did or didn't do on these tests and what they said to you all about testing and the state of for yourselves and your fellow students. Ed, why don't you start?
I guess I can field this question first. So I noticed that we're all seniors here, and we're all seniors in Montgomery County. So I think we all missed PARC actually by 1 year. So we're...
Aren't you lucky?
And I noticed that that's to the relief of some of our parents and also some of our peers. With that said, we're all we're from the MSA generation. We took the MSA. In second grade, we took a test called, was it Map Art? No, it was like a preparatory test in second grade. We took Map Art, I think, from third grade to eighth grade, just like the MSA. From what I can understand, the MSA is drastically different from PARC testing. Sort of the response I've heard, he mentioned the town hall that we had like a month or a month and a half ago. I attended that town hall, and there were not only some of the students up here, but there were also parents and teachers who have experienced the first sort of implementation of PARC. And sort of the overwhelming response is that it's just confusing to the students. I took some time and I checked out what PARC really is, because I realized that I might have to address the question on this panel. I just opened up, just very briefly, I opened up like a math section of PARC, and just immediately what I saw is that for a third grader who's under a time constraint and it's their first time testing and maybe they haven't like fully realized the gravity of the situation, or maybe they've sort of bought into too much the gravity of the situation, using all of the tools and understanding the format, it must be very difficult. It must just be very, it might be too much to take in as a third grader, even as an eighth grader completing the PARC. There are like there's like a toolbar where you can have like a ruler and a protractor. The questions are phrased differently from maybe what you experience as a first or second grader. So just as a whole, it might be a sort of overwhelming experience. But I understand that it's like a beta testing. So like it's just like the first sort of implementation of the test. So there are always going to be problems. But from what I understand, speaking from the perspective of someone who hasn't taken the PARC, it must be sort of like a difficult endeavor.
Angie?
Actually, I was told that I had to take the PARC in order for me to graduate, but like my class was like a guinea pig for it, so it didn't really matter if we passed or not. Our teacher told us, I know it's a hard test, you don't really have to pass, you just have to take it to graduate, and of course I want to graduate. So we were given about 15 minutes the day before to get used to the tools on the actual test, and I didn't understand anything. Like, we'd raise our hand to ask our teacher, can you help us with this? She was like, I don't even know what it is. And the test itself, it had nothing to do with, because I was in Algebra 2 last year, Honors Algebra 2, and it had nothing to do with algebra. Like, it was very difficult. Half of my answers I wrote, I don't know. Because, not just because I didn't know the answer, but I didn't even know how to use the tools on it. So it was a very difficult test, and yeah.
So what you just said, just for 2 seconds, so when you didn't, so does that mean that the test was testing things from what you saw that you had not been taught in class? Or a different way of approaching the subject? What did that mean?
Both. There was things on the test that I've never seen before. And my teacher even said, she was like, yeah, we didn't cover this yet, and I don't even think we will. And there was also
things. And that was in algebra?
Yeah, algebra 2.
2-2, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And the park test was just general algebra, but I took honors algebra 2, and still there was things on the test that I didn't know. And also there was tools there that I didn't know how to use. And I was like, if I need to get a protractor, like, I didn't know how to get it. And it was, like, timed as well. So it was very stressful.
Wow. Melissa, do you want to jump in on that a little bit?
Well, all I have to say, I didn't take it, so I'm not really sure. But I do have a couple friends who took it, and they've told me the same thing that Angie says. It was really hard for them to figure out how to use it, and it was time-consuming, so they were rushed. Most of the things on it, they didn't know how to do it. So it was, as she said, they just put, I don't know, and it was just to graduate, so they didn't really try either because it was hard for them to do.
I'm curious about some things we talked about last panel, but let me turn first. Nicholas, do you want to say something, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I'm pretty sure it was given over like a couple of days or a week, the park test, and we were juniors when it happened, and the sophomores unfortunately had to take it, so they had to take that, and they still had to prepare for their HSAs and their final exams. And I really clearly remember the week of the park test team, because not only were they super stressed, but the teachers were stressed because they were the ones proctoring the exam. So they had to go out of their classrooms, go out of their way of teaching to proctor these exams, that even they had confusing directions on how to time each section. And like, they were stressed because the students were, you could see their faces while they took the exams, and they apparently were like, I don't know what this like means. Like, and that like has an effect on them. Like, throughout that week, they just thought like, wow, like, they just gave me a test that I had no idea what was going on, and I just feel bad about myself now. So, like, you could see the faces on all my sophomore friends completely stressed out about this exam because they weren't able to fully answer the questions. And, like, I have friends that still get good grades, and, like, they were doing good in their classes, and they're just given this exam, and that's just a complete, like, blow to their confidence of what they've been learning so far, because then they think that, oh, maybe, like, I haven't been learning as well as I thought I have.
And Ariana, I know that the last time we spoke on the last panel, you and Angie both spoke, I think, a lot to the siblings and younger people and what you experienced just watching them.
My sister, last year she was an eighth grader, and she took the park test. She said that, like, the test was stupid. She said it didn't make any sense. You know, my sister, she's like your average slacker, but gets, like, a 4.0. So the test, like, didn't really faze her. But she just said it was stupid, like, pointless, like, it didn't make any sense, so she didn't understand why she had to take it.
None of us like taking tests, ever. I hated them. We had to do them. I hated giving them, and I hated taking them, because then I had to grade them, and that was even worse sometimes. But when you look at the numbers of students in Montgomery County, where you come from, who met the test, 45%, I think, and one of the, I have them all written down here, I was trying to parse all this stuff out. But so what is that? I'm curious what this all says to you about what you think testing ought to be to, A, help you all as students, but, B, to help people evaluate and understand what is actually happening in the classroom and what students are learning. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there's got to be, we all have to have some accountability on some level. So how would you envision that? Angie, I see you got the mic, so why don't you jump?
Yeah, I definitely think that it should be teachers creating these tests, not people who are not in the classroom with us, not people who have no idea how fast we're learning and at what pace. Because when we're given these tests, like, it's like we're given these tests from people who don't know. Like, for example, a teacher knows how fast her class is learning. A teacher knows at what pace her students are going to be learning. So a teacher should create the test. So if, for example, if we're taking the park testing and they, on the park testing, the only thing we know is like half of the test and not the other half, like, what does that do for us? Because it's not like you can correctly evaluate students when they don't even know what's on the test. It makes no sense. It'd make better sense if you'd evaluate students on things that you know they know. For example, a teacher knows what students know because she knows that she taught you guys correctly.
There will be people who will say that if 55% of students in a given jurisdiction are not passing this PARC test or whatever, and then we know numbers of students in different jurisdictions have a real low rate in terms of reading ability and math ability. So what does that say to you in terms of the testing? So I'm saying, I mean, how do we, A, understand what students know and don't know in terms of your peer conversations, and how should we better understand that?
I also agree with Angie about the how, like, teachers should be able to make the tests that we take, because the teachers are the only ones who really know what we're going through, like, in our class. You know, if we have, like, a quiz that day, and we tell the teacher, like, we do not know what's going on, blah, blah, the teacher can take another day, you know, and give us more resources on how we can learn it better. But, you know, when you take these final exams and all this stuff, it's that day. If you don't take it that day, you fail. And I think that if that's how we're doing it, then all students are just going to do is fail. And 55% of students not passing the PARC should tell them something that, A, we need to change what we're teaching, or change when we take these tests, change how we take these tests. You know, we shouldn't have this many people failing a test, and then, you know, it counts for something.
Well, I just want to comment, too, on the fact of the language barrier. I know that was a big thing for my little cousins. They're in middle school, and they took it, and they just came. So it was really hard, and they forced them to take it, too. And it was really hard for them because they don't know English, and they had to take it. So obviously, they had no idea what was going on in the test, so they couldn't do it. And that also adds to the reason why the percentage of passing the test is so low.
Somebody wrote in here from the audience, are students aware that many of these tests are used to grade their schools? And if so, do they think this is valid accountability?
Here's the other thing that I think about with the tests, because the tests are also grading like the teacher's ability, well, like they think they're grading the teacher's ability and based on the classes, which is why a lot of teachers always try to remember what was given on the test the year before. And I just think that's counterproductive, because then they end up having to teach structured based on the tests, and that just really like structures, like it prevents them from teaching what they want to teach and teaching with their freedom. That's just going to hold them down more, and they have to teach geared towards these tests, and that's just going to make it harder for the students as well as for the teachers, because then the students have to learn very structuredly and not as openly as they can be learning, which makes it easier for them, and the teachers the same thing. So then the teachers and students are both graded based on these tests that really just like hold down learning.
Yeah, I'd like to say two things in regard to that question. First of all, I think it's just not, I think everyone in this room recognizes that it's not as cut and dry as a school gets a high grade, therefore it's a good school, or a school gets a poor grade and therefore it's a poor school. That's just one indicator. And even MCPS, or the county that we come from, Montgomery County Public Schools, even they recognize that, because that's only one of the indicators that they use. They also use AP testing, or number of students that take APs. They also use number of students who succeed in HSAs. They use number of students who take higher level math courses like Algebra 2 and Calculus. So there's that. Huh. There's also like a distinction between schools that are in wealthier areas in Maryland, and also schools that are in poor regions. That disparity is not only like a wealth disparity, but in my opinion, it's also sort of like a preparedness disparity, because students who come from typically wealthier regions, they're generally more prepared for these tests because they have the resources around them to prepare them. I work at a tutoring center called Kumon in my hometown of Rockville. It's like a place where students go to really brush up on their math and reading skills in this sort of like really rigorous way. And the children there, they're disproportionately white and Asian students, and they live in that sort of area of Rockville, which is wealthier than other parts of Montgomery County. They're like, from what I see from the material that they're learning from, they're very, very well prepared for the things that they might encounter in a park test or any sort of test similar to that. So I think if we're going to address the problem of schools being graded by their test scores, we have to also address the problem of the fact that schools that encounter lower performances, that's because their students are less prepared because they don't come from backgrounds where they have that really rock-solid foundation of I'm going to Kumon, I'm going to brush up on my math and reading skills every day from 4 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon after school. So that's definitely something that needs to be taken into consideration.
I was also thinking about knowledge, about like the students knowing that there's going to be, like, for example, I didn't know there was an SAT until I went into high school, and I could have prepared in my other, like, in middle school or something, but I didn't know that there was such a thing to do. So that also affected me because I didn't have enough knowledge, and that's just not, that's not me. It's also a lot more people who go through that. Also, as Anders said, the poverty, we really have to focus on poverty too, because with the classes, I know there's SAT classes and there's other things that you can take, like you can get tutored. A lot of people don't have access to that, and most of those classes have a minimum of 300 points that you can get more on the SAT, and that affects other students because then they don't have that chance to get those points.
The last panel we did, there was a parent that stood up, pulled her children out of the test. Remember, and when she said they opted out, there was this kind of round of applause from all the teachers and everybody else and parents in the room. So I'm just curious, this is what students talk about in that regard, and what do you think about the idea of people opting out?
I personally think that's a great idea. if I knew I didn't have to take some of these tests, I probably would be a lot less stressed. I probably would have a few better grades in my classes, and I'd just probably be a happier person. I feel like tests, the tests that you take, some of these tests, they tell you, like, oh, it doesn't matter. But then when you realize that you take the test, and then next year your classes are, you're like in the lower portion, like you're the lower classes, the not on level classes anymore, then you like realize, oh, that test really did matter. Like, it really did matter. And I didn't try, or I was too stressed out about it, or I just couldn't get a good grade on it. And like, if I could have opted out of taking those tests, I probably would have started off in high school a lot higher than I was, and I had to move myself up personally instead of already being there.
Any other quick thoughts on that before we have another question here from the audience? Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, just touching on what Ariana said. I feel like by all these tests that are given to us, they really make you feel insecure. For example, I have two younger sisters. Last year, one of my younger sisters was in the fifth grade, and she had to take the PARC testing and the MSAs and all that. And I've never seen a fifth grader stress like she was stressing. It was crazy. Like, she was like, I have to get a good night's sleep. If I don't get a good grade, then I'm going to be dumb. And I don't think that's fair for a child of her age to feel that way. And also, by giving students all these, I feel like these tests are unnecessary and making them feel dumb, that's taking kids out of school. What's our future looking like? Because now teachers don't want to teach anymore, because all they're basically doing is just giving students information so they can memorize it, because we're not learning. Because everything we do in school, I could easily do it at home on my phone. If I wanted to learn about math, I could just go on YouTube and learn about math. Because in school, I'm not doing that. I'm just memorizing. I don't even know what I learned in math last week because I took a test, so I forgot about it. So it's really not, like, our workforce is going to be so small when we get in the future, because there's nobody in school anymore, and there's nobody to, quote unquote, teach us anymore, because nobody wants to be in school because there's too many tests and it's too much stress, and it makes you feel like you're dumb, you're worthless. And then these teachers, they're like, I'm not even teaching these kids. I'm just throwing them information so they can take a test, so they can pass it, so that they can move on to the next grade level.
This audience member who asked this question, thanking all of you for sharing your experiences, one of the questions they had here was, one of the explanations we have heard to justify low PARC scores is that students didn't try because they were told the grades wouldn't count. Is that your experience? Or is that the experience? I know most of you didn't take the PARC, Is that the experience of most people around you that you talk to when you sit and talk about these tests?
That was my experience for sure. I did not try on that test. I mean, I usually when teachers tell me, oh, you know, you just have to take it to pass, I kind of tell myself, Angie, you got to do good. But when I got there, I was, you know, feeling confident in myself, like, yeah, you got this. It's just another MSA, like, whatever. I opened the computer. It took me forever to log in because that login process was, I don't even know. And I just got there and I was like, what is this? And then, like, at first I was like, you know, maybe it's just because you probably didn't pay attention in class. But then when you start hearing, like, the whispers around the room, like, what is this? When did we learn this? And then you're like, okay, it's not just me. And then you just kind of give up. And then you just write, I don't know. So
Nicholas?
Yeah, from what I heard from my peers that did take the test, that, like, most of them were going to try. And they were like, whatever, like, let's just see how I do on this. And then as soon as they opened up the test, as soon as they logged on, they were like, okay, well, there goes trying. It doesn't count anyway, and I'm not going to. I already have, like, other things to worry about and because of school. So if this doesn't count, I might as well focus on the things that are going to be graded in the future. And I also wanted to touch on the point about mental health, because counselors at my school and the principal and everyone have really realized the amount of stress that I go to Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda. It is a hugely competitive school, and it's only getting more competitive. So the amount of stress that my peers go through is immense. We had a student, I don't like to touch about this, but he unfortunately committed suicide last year because of stress-related causes. And we have implemented a new program at our school called Sources of Strength. And we have a new texting hotline because we don't really like call anymore. So you can text that hotline at any time. And it's like, and it's people that just like are there to like hear you out, because there's been a huge increase in stress. And we really do need to focus on the things of mental health, because students are being impacted, and mental health needs to be realized and implemented more throughout schools.
Somebody went beyond actually taking the test. Will you talk about, one, how many of those classes, how many other classes you missed to take the tests? Two, how often your teacher was out of class to give tests to other students? And C, how often you could not be in the media center because of tests?
So for the PARC test, I know I had three teachers who all had to give tests. So I missed a few, like, learning days because my teachers were out. And then we had a sub. You know, the subs don't do anything. They don't know what they're talking about. So, you know, you miss out on, like, a few learning days. All of the labs at our school were taking up. So, like, at lunch, you couldn't use a lab. So if you had to do a essay or project or something, you couldn't finish it. And the tests were like 2 or 3 weeks, so that's a whole 3 weeks that someone could be missing out on their classes, missing out on their teacher time, missing out on their lab time. And I don't think it's fair to use up all of our resources for a test that quote unquote doesn't matter.
Angie, go ahead.
So
I think thank you.
The first day for PARC, I missed every class, like the first half, so up until fourth period, and then the rest of that day. None of my teachers were in class. I had subs. And then for those next 2 weeks, I think it was like on average like 3 or 4 teachers were missing. So, and during that time, we were doing final exam stuff. So it was like you couldn't really prepare for final exams because your teacher wasn't in class.
Somebody wants to know, are AP and IP tests useful? If so, what makes them more useful than PARC?
So coming from like a mainly AP and IB background in my high school education, I can definitely speak to this because sort of like the textbook distinction that the AP and the IB programs would make would be that AP and IB focus on college preparedness, whereas PARC is more like someone mentioned before, like a grading standard for schools in determining how well their students are performing just on a general level. I don't think I'm in a position to say which one is more important than the other. They're both very important because we need to know, there needs to be some sort of indicator of how well primary and secondary level education, like students are performing. And AP and IB tests are useful in their own way, but there's a time for each. So I think that PARC testing is useful in its own in its own time period, that third to eighth grade time period. And I'll pause before I say it's useful because I'm not sure how useful it really is compared to like the MSA testing. but like a like an indication test of how well students are performing. That's definitely useful. But AP and IB tests, they go like above and beyond sort of like the normal curriculum, the normal things that you'd learn in the classroom. And I think especially we all come from the Minority Scholars Program. Especially among minorities, there needs to be like a particular emphasis placed on AP and IB, not only testing, but just that sort of that method of conceptualization, like that mode of learning, because it does help with college preparedness. I think that's I can speak to that because my writing has improved, the way I think about certain mathematical concepts, that's improved too in my time as an AP and IB student. So it's hard to, like I said, nothing is very cut and dry. It's hard to say whether one is more useful than the other because they're both useful in their own sort of spheres. But AP and IB tests, I will say, are especially useful to the students who go into the rigorous, not only college applicant pool, but also workforce, and who need those skills of like a different kind of conceptualization and ways of learning.
As we close this out, and I know, Melissa, you look like you want to say something, as does Nicholas on this, but maybe we can then go down the line and maybe just have really quick closing thoughts that you want to leave folks with before we end the panel.
I just wanted to touch really briefly on the previous question. I do think AP tests are useful because of the college preparedness, and they help you get credits, but I really wanted to focus on the accessibility of those because they're getting more expensive every year, and I'm pretty sure last year there were like 80 a test. So if I took three AP courses last year, so that's a lot of money, and there's people that take five or six AP courses, and the accessibility of that towards minorities or people of lower income, which are most likely usually minorities, that's just not fair. And then closing thoughts, I really think we're working towards a good cause, and more and more we're going to be able to like have students, like hopefully, like for example, like I don't know, in 20 years or something, when I have kids, and I'll come home and I'll be like, how was school? They'll be able to tell me it was really good, even though I learned things that for me personally, I'm not going to pursue them. They were really interesting and I learned a lot, and I want to continue to learn because I really think we've lost the want to learn, and I really think we need to regain it.
And very quickly, down the line, really quickly, Melissa Escobar, then we'll go down.
Okay, so basically just saying before, I had the privilege to take an IB test. I took some classes, and I really liked it because it was less stressful and it was more time and it was more open-minded questions. I think that gave me the privilege to actually focus and know what I was going to test. The class itself was more open, and I just really enjoyed the IB. I took IB, social anthro. So it was really nice. I loved it. Closing thoughts, I think that we should focus also on poverty issues and on socioeconomic issues, because that also affects the privilege and the knowledge that some students can receive, and it will help improve our grades and our testing grades too. So
to talk about the AP test for a little bit.
Just a second. We're out of time yet.
The AP tests, I feel like, are definitely more important. You know, you study harder for those, but I feel like if you pass it, you know, you get your college credit, and that they're a little more important. And then my closing thoughts are I hope that eventually students won't be looked as data points. They'll be looked as students who are in the classrooms. Who will look at students who are in the classrooms trying to learn, trying to get a higher education, and that these testing experiences will be a lot better in the future.
Same as what Nick said. We need to bring back the want to learn, because we're not learning, we're memorizing, and we're just memorizing for some data points that really don't even affect us. Our future is not looking bright. We're not going to have a lot of people in the workforce. We're not going to have, like, the next president's dreams could have been crushed because they got a basic on the MSAs. We really need to think about, like, what these tests are doing to kids, because they're not helping us. They're crushing us.
And I just leave you this thought that I just got a note here from one of my producers who's here, who was an honor student and an ACE, and she said, the only way I was able to take the AP tests is because my high school subsidized them on a certain amount based on students' quarterly grades. So A's got you $20 off and so on. But it was still a big financial burden for my parents. Something to think about when we talk about what we, how we teach and test our children as we go to our next panel. Thank you, you guys are great and make me feel good about where we're going next. Thank you all so much. I want to thank the Montgomery County Public Schools Minority Scholars who joined me for this conversation. Angela Lilo and Melissa Escobar from Richard Montgomery High School. Nicholas Ballone of Walter Johnson High School. And Ariana Jones and Angie Salima of Clarksburg High School. We have to take a brief break, but when we come back, we continue this conversation about testing with people working on it at the state and national level. Stay with us. This is Mark Steiner. Please join me on January the 13th for the 13th Annual Annapolis Summit at the Governor Calvert House on the opening day of the state legislature in Annapolis. It's your chance to have your questions answered when we talk with Governor Larry Hogan, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. Save your seat and get more information about sponsorships as well at thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit or by contacting Morgan Cook at 443-524-8181 or morgan.cook@thedailyrecord.com. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by The Daily Record, Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, Alexander and Cleaver, VPC, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and WEAA. Be part of the Annapolis Summit. Be there, 443-524-8181. Welcome back. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. This morning, we bring you a conversation I moderated on school testing at the 2015 Maryland State Education Association Education Policy Forum held in Annapolis. We just heard student perspectives on school testing. We now turn to a group of people who are working on the issue of testing at the state and national level.
Sitting to my left is Liz Barrett, who was elected to the Frederick County Board of Education in November 2014. As its vice president December 2014. Next to her is Judith Brown Dianis, who is co-director of the Advancement Project since its inception in 1999. And next to her is Monty Neal, executive director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, Fair Test, and we'll begin. So I want to pick up where we left off with the students in some ways. We're now in this world where we've gone through so much in testing. Even I, who have been into this for a long time, have to go to my book to kind of even remember all of the tests that we have created. I mean, I remember it was the ESEA. It was created in 1965 as part of Lyndon Baines Johnson's War on Poverty. Vietnam didn't let it get war didn't get let it get funded. It was a great idea. It was supposed to bring equality to education. Then we've gone through No Child Left Behind, and now we're about to hit ESSA. So when we look at the policy source, kind of understanding how to evaluate our children and evaluate the work we do as educators, people do as educators, what are we missing here? I mean, something has really been missing out of all these debates and conversations, mm-hmm. It seems to me. So as we get ready to hit this state legislative session here in Maryland, those debates will happen again. So what are we missing in these debates?
Sure. So first, thanks for having me. For those who don't know Advancement Project, we are a national civil rights organization that does work, very known for our work around the school-to-prison pipeline, but we also have been doing work around equity issues and most recently around school closures that are spreading throughout the country. And to answer your, and I'm on the board of Fair Test, by the way, so I'm going to give, and I was asked to be here to give a civil rights perspective, but what you should know is that my organization has also been called part of the civil wrongs movement because we don't believe in high-stakes testing like many civil rights organizations do. So I think what is missing from all that we have done is equity. ESEA was supposed to be about equity. It was supposed to be about closing a gap. And while we have had so many discussions around accountability, we keep missing the discussion about equity. I have a daughter who goes to school in Prince George's County, Maryland. And so I know from being in schools and watching her go through that system from kindergarten, she's now in eighth grade, I have witnessed inequity. And I think part of the problem is that we have a lack and dearth of public will around educating every child and giving them the highest quality education possible. And that public will, that loss, that lack of public will is what is hurting our babies. That our children are going to schools that are under-resourced. We under-resource them. We say that, you know, okay, we're going to give some money, but we're going to give some money equally, which is not what equity is about. Sometimes you have to give more money in order to bring children up, right? And then what we do is we say, well, those schools are failing. We label those children. We label the schools, we label the adults, we label the teachers in those schools as big, fat failures. And then what we do is, because we failed them, we're going to close down the school. And then when we close down the school, we're going to send those children to some other school that is just on the brink of so-called failure. And so children get shuffled around, all looking for equity, just traveling around looking for equity. And unfortunately, you know, this is an age-old story. It is nothing new. That we continue to have a system of education in this country that has not ever closed the education gap for children of color.
Monty?
Amen. So that's the first part. My organization, Fair Test, it's on the web at fairtest.org. We've just completed 30 years of being here and trying to make testing and assessment of students rational, fair, educationally sound, and helpful. The first thing is that testing itself will not bring equity. The promise of No Child Left Behind is that accountability would lead to equity, and it simply has not done, whether you look at the inputs, the resources, or the outcomes, because even on the independent national assessment of educational progress, the rate of improvement on those test scores, standardized test scores, was faster before No Child Left Behind than after No Child Left Behind. So even on its own terms of test scores, it simply didn't work. And the equity has not been there, and it's become a mask for avoiding the issues of funding and resources and assistance, or addressing the issues outside of school. Schools historically contribute to about 25% of the variance in student outcomes. The rest comes from family and community and social wealth or lack of wealth and various other similar kinds of factors. The other thing to pay attention to is that the testing has come to define teaching and learning. The claim is they indicate whether a kid has learned, but they don't and they can't. If you want to know if a kid is going to be successful in life, well, the best of those tests, the SAT and the ACT, predict about 16-18% of the variance in college grades. The rest of it is not predicted by the test. The PARC, by the way, was studied in Massachusetts, and it predicts 5-18% of the variance, so it's not even as good as the SAT. The point being that this narrow, narrow slice of basically basic skills is a very limited amount of what people want from their schools, of what kids need in order to thrive. There's been studies done. Yeah, people, of course, want academics for their kids, but they also would like to know that their kids are healthy and happy. They want them to be good citizens. They want their children to experience the arts. They want them to be good in social relationships. They want to make sure they get phys ed and health. There's a whole array of things that we sometimes call the whole child. And tests measure a narrow slice of a narrow slice, and that's all they measure. And yet we are reducing schooling to testing and test prep, as the students talked about. You're losing weeks of time on just the test, never mind the time spent on the test prep. So I think the issues here that we are fundamentally facing are, on the one side, equity, and on the other side, if we're going to talk equity about quality of schooling, what do we mean by quality of schooling? Testing obscures and distracts from the first and undermines and destroys the second.
Liz?
Thanks again for having me today. You know, I was really struck by, in the last panel, what Ms. Escobar from Richard Montgomery said. And she said it two or three times. And what's missing is addressing poverty. And we talk about equity. We talk about those issues. And, you know, I'm from Frederick County, and we're the biggest county in the state of Maryland geographically. And we've seen population changes in Frederick County. Our demographics have changed tremendously. And, you know, Frederick County was one of the top school districts in the state of Maryland, and maybe it still is. But I have seen in the last several years a precipitous drop in some of our achievement. And I'm not talking about park scores. I'm not talking about HSAs. I'm talking about just general students, number of students going on to higher education, and some of those other measures. We still have very good schools, but we are not addressing root causes in Frederick County. And one of the reasons I wanted to run for office in Frederick County is because I am interested in working together as a county to deal with some of these equity issues, because students come to school and it suddenly is the under-resourced school's job and the under-resourced teacher in the classroom to address every single other factor in this child's life and every failure in the community. And that's poverty, that's racial and ethnic discrimination, that's all of the failings of our social service community that's also underfunded, and so the equity issue. But I think to your original question, you know, what's missing? So there is dealing with all of those other issues. But what's missing, I think, is actually what's been there all along. It's just been covered up by this notion of accountability and this hyper-focus on testing. What's been there all along, it's not missing, is we still have quality educators. People study education. People want to be teachers because they care about children and they care about public education, because we all believe in public education. And at the end of the day, there are teachers who lose morale and get frustrated and don't want to be held accountable because they're doing the best they can for the kids they have. And those teachers' motivations, those teachers' skills, and their caring is all there. It's not gone anywhere. So it's not missing. It just needs to be uncovered and allowed to bloom again. And I think that's one of our crucial jobs as policymakers, as elected officials, and certainly as parents and community members. It's to get back to that point.
Judith, you talked about more money, and is one of the things that's needed to kind of invest in our children, especially kids who are poor. And I think you all were saying the same thing, Liz and Monty, when you said that accountability has not led to equity. But I can also hear the debates taking place in Congress and the debates taking place in the state legislature, which will be about, what do you mean we don't spend enough money? We throw more money at education than almost anything else that we do. We throw tons of education in some of the poorest districts in the state. So what's missing? And so, but A and B, so let me just add the caveat to that, is that, so what, again, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, what is missing then? Is there something in the way we approach education, money may be part of it, that does not allow us to get to what the 21st century has given us. I mean, I think about the changes education has gone through since the end of legal segregation in the 60s to where we are today. Something, there's a big missing hole here in terms of, someone said on my program not long ago that part of the problem is, I've seen Pedro Noguero said this as well, which was that we have not come up with methods of teaching children whose families have historically never went to schools. What are we missing here in terms of how we teach and educate our kids? Judith, go ahead.
That was a lot. I've been recently, my daughter is going into ninth grade, and I've had to face a really hard decision about where she's going to go to high school. And my mom was a superintendent in New York City. She worked away from a third grade teacher. I went to public school, and we're at this brink of, should I take her out? And it is one of the hardest decisions that I have ever had to make in my life. I will tell you that when I go to visit some of these private schools, I am amazed at what goes on in terms of the creativity, in terms of the engagement with the students, the love for the students, the getting to know the student, the relationships that are built. My daughter sat in classes and she came, I remember her as coming back and saying, they have so much freedom. Like, they're, not only is it just freedom to like walk down the hall and not, you know, walk on a line, right? With your hands behind your back, right? And at lunch they get to sit with who they want to sit with. And then the classroom, the teachers are just talking to them, engaging them, and talking to them about things that are not just in the textbook and not just about reading this paragraph and bubbling in these circles. So part of it is that I think we have sucked the joy out of school, both from the teacher's perspective and the student's perspective.
And that is because we thought that in this ideal way of getting accountability, we would just make it so narrow and what we thought would be so easy. But what it did was that it bored the hell out of everybody, including the students. And so what that meant was that our students are disengaged. They don't want to be there. The teachers often don't want to be there. And so we have these two worlds of people who don't want to be in the environment in which they have to be every day. And so I think part of it is, how do we get back? How do we reimagine, right? And it actually, you know, when I think about it, like, it doesn't take much for me to think about what a classroom should look like, because I was in one of those classrooms in a public school with Mrs. Klein, who was a wonderful English teacher. I remember reading The Tale of Two Cities and having an incredible discussion, and reading about the Scarlet Letter, and reading about talking about symbolism, and all of the things that just weren't about how are we going to pass that test. So part of it is, how do we get back to that? The thing that is ironic to me is that in this move for accountability, we said for public schools, we need to get you testing, filling in bubbles, but then we're going to create this other system. It's called the charter system. Mm-hmm. And we're going to allow them to be creative. And guess what? Unaccountable, right? And not that there's actually a lot of creativity going on in a lot of those charter schools. I can tell you that that's not happening. But it's interesting that we decided to do both of those things, right, at the same time. We wanted accountability, but we decided to have a system that has no accountability. And so I think this is really, like, we know what works. We know how to engage students. And I think we just have to get back to that, but figure out the measurement piece of how do we measure without narrowing.
So,
okay.
Yeah, because I can give you another example from the public schools today, and it's also a testing, an assessment answer. So there's a group of schools in New York State called the New York Performance Standards Consortium. You can look them up at performanceassessment.org. They started several decades ago. They've recently expanded to 38 schools, all but two in New York City. They're all public schools. They're not charters. They're regular public schools. The students get admission to these schools by the standard admissions procedure in New York City, which is you apply to schools. And if there's too many, they do have lotteries and so on. But now the students in these schools are demographically mirror pretty much exactly the demographics of New York City by race, class, disability, and language status. Many of these students, on average, the students come into these schools with lower test scores than the city average. Those students then go through this school. And I don't know all of them as well as I know some, but the one I know best, Urban Academy, it's a project-oriented school. So students are deeply engaged in projects and get a real say over the process of teaching and learning. They'll often work with teachers about what the next courses they want to see and set up are. So they cover all the basics, but they do a lot of it through these teacher and student design courses. And the students then do projects to graduate. They have to pass extended performance tasks in language arts, math, science, and history. The students design and pick their own projects. They often come out of courses. They have to do it together with the teacher, and they certainly can't just pick anything. You won't be able to read comic books and get your pass your language arts. But if you are interested in Shakespeare, and she is interested in Hemingway, and she is interested in Toni Morrison, that's all fine. You don't have to do the same thing. You don't all have to read Faulkner instead. You get to dig on. So what happens to these students? Well, they graduate at much higher rates. For English language learners and students with disabilities, the graduation rate is about double the city average. Still not great, to tell you the truth, but it's double the city average. They send more students to college than the city average. Of those students who go to college, if you look at the third semester and beyond, more of their students are staying in college than the national average, which includes all the rich kids, the suburban kids, and all the rest. That is, they are, by real world, that is, getting in and succeeding in college, they're successes. And they are successes because their assessment system and their instruction is teacher-controlled, teacher-designed, practitioner-led. It's student-centered. So you have lots of very serious student engagement. And I've talked to some of these students. They just amaze me, some of the stuff they've done and they know. I've heard them on panels. I've talked to them individually, seen them on videotape. It's amazing stuff. Now, there's no magic to this. It's hard work on the part of teachers. They expect a lot of the students. It's not like, oh, they have low expectations. Students are going to college. They're telling me, oh, yeah, I've had kids from fancy prep schools come up and ask me for help on how to write essays because I had to write 20-page essays to graduate. So this is the kind of stuff that goes on, serious academic work, but real engagement on the part of the students. Now, that is their assessment system. Yeah, the kids all have to take and pass one of the 5 graduation tests in New York, the language arts test. They're waived from all of the others. So you don't need all the tests to know how well schools are doing. You've got real-world evidence. You don't need the tests to inspire the kids. In fact, as Judy said, they disengage the students. You have real work that inspires the kids because they can be engaged. There's no magic. These kids are poor, largely low-income kids, many with not strong English when they start. They do well. They succeed. We can do different if we choose. We have to choose it.
Liz?
I thought what Judith said was so interesting about sucking the joy out. You know, I think joy is not expensive. It doesn't mean, you know, it really isn't. You don't have to throw tons and tons of money to create engagement and joy. I think our teachers, many of our teachers know how to do that. And the ones that are not doing it now, many of them are burned out and are suffering morale issues or just feeling underappreciated, whether that has to do with compensation or whether that has to do with the testing and assessment environment. And I came here really to talk about some of our local issues in Frederick County. You know, I am a Frederick County person. I grew up there, and I went to our public schools there. And sort of this, you know, with what happened with ESSA and No Child Left Behind, and I'm just so exhausted by talking about education policy nationally, because until we really are talking about the changes that we can make locally, you know, and I was pleased that there's some new direction here. We're able to really start negotiating some local control, and I'm a happy Democrat to use that word, because money is time, and the question was about resources. Time is money, and when we look in Frederick County or in anywhere in the state of Maryland, and we look at the amount of time spent in pre-preparation, in preparation, in practice testing, and then in testing itself, if you take a teacher's salary and you'd make it an hourly wage, and then you look at all the people who are involved with test preparation, with the curriculum design that's aligned with the new assessments, you get a big number. And you get time that teachers are not being able to spend. And in the really, some amazing teachers are able to weave those moments of joy into test preparation. But it is disappointing and it's frustrating.
You're listening to a panel on school testing that took place earlier this month at the 2015 Education Policy Forum, convened in Annapolis by the Maryland State Education Association. I'm talking with Liz Barrett of the Frederick County Board of Education, Judith Brown Dianis of the Advancement Project, and Monty Neal of Fair Test. Stay with me to hear the rest of the conversation right after this break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And this morning, we bring you a conversation I moderated on school testing at the 2015 Maryland State Education Association Education Policy Forum in Annapolis. I was joined by Liz Barrett of the Frederick County Board of Education, Judith Brown Dianis of the Advancement Project, and Monty Neal of Fair Test.
This idea that test prep is like, you know, it's like they're preparing for the Super Bowl. And I've said it before in our own board meetings, you know, there's, you know, they rev the kids up and they give them special snacks. And they, those are the nights the administrators write home and say, you know, you got to have a healthy breakfast tomorrow and a good night's sleep. Well, good grief. What's the rest of the year then? What's the rest of the year? And these kids, you know, their breakfast and their healthy night's sleep matter every night. It's not just for test prep. It's telling them they're only, you know, they're only valuable. Their performance in school is only valuable on the day that it counts for the school and for the county. It's simply not true. And so for me, time is money. Absolutely, our public schools need more money. Our teachers need more compensation. One of the things I learned was, you know, in the state of Maryland, you imagine a kid with a backpack and you've got your per pupil allotment from your county money and your state money. And somebody said, well, imagine every kid in Frederick County is walking around with a little backpack with $11,000 to $12,000 in it, which is kind of what your per pupil allotment. Well, it doesn't work out that way because there's a lot of kids who don't need $12,000 worth of services, perhaps. But there's a lot of kids who need like $400,000 worth of services. And at the end of the day, you have to educate every student, and time is money, and peeling back on the preparation, the administration of tests, the amount of people in central office and other places who are involved in getting ready for tests is going to save us a lot of money, and then we can get back to the joy pieces and the real enrichment and real engagement.
We also have to bring our classroom and what happens in classrooms into this age, right? You know, with children who and students and teenagers who are always online. Oh, you know, like it's a different age. So how are we going to engage this generation, not the last generation, right? How are we going to go into, you know, I've seen classrooms where you go into the classroom, you know, often students like to be sitting in a circle instead of in lines, right? Classroom lines, so they can see each other, so that they can engage with one another, so that they can have a conversation, so that the teacher in the morning can say, how's everybody doing? Let's do, you know, we at Advance the Project do a lot of work with young people around restorative justice programs. And young people actually like the fact that somebody came in, asked them how they're doing. Everybody goes around, talks about how they're doing for the day. Because if we think about the fact that there are a lot of young people who are coming to classrooms where no one asked them how they were doing, and just that one question could engage them for the rest of the day because there's someone who cares. Often that's what a lot of young people are looking for, is someone who cares. And so having that kind of environment and a classroom where young people can engage, where they can do projects together, where they can really sit and talk about things as opposed to just reading and seeing what's on the board. Write down the notes. Here's what's on the notes. And I know that part of it is that we have to get through a program. I remember a teacher telling me in my daughter's math class that we, you know, I asked, well, you know, we have a problem with this particular subject that you were teaching in math. And, you know, I want to know, like, when are we going to have time for this classroom? Because I know if my daughter's having problems, there's probably a lot of other kids who are having problems. When are we going to have time to do this? And she's like, well, I've got to move on. The book tells me I have to move on to the next thing. And I was like, well, then that means I didn't learn the last thing. And you're just going to, and math is cumulative, right? So if I didn't learn that 3 weeks ago and you've built on it, then the foundation of the house is weak. And so, but the pressure to keep moving on and to not have that engaging conversation is really hurting this generation of students.
Liz, you want to jump in real fast while we move on?
Just where we're talking about costs of testing and costs of assessments, I think one of the things too, and you were talking about how technology to some degree can be used to really engage students. You know, at the local level, one of the things we've had to invest in is technology specifically for testing. And it costs a lot, and it's going to be outdated, and it doesn't always work. And, you know, trying to formulate a strategic plan that really brings in technology to improve learning does not mesh with the kind of stuff you have to buy to make sure you have enough iPads or Chromebooks or whatever for the PARC test. And so you can have a real, legitimate, well-funded technology strategic plan, and then you can have the fact that over here you've got to invest in different technology for testing. And we talk about actual strains and what things that cost money, and those are things that cost money, and it doesn't align with actual learning and the mastery, the deep mastery that you're talking about.
We have, I think, for very different reasons, a lot of people who are not happy about the state of education in our state, in our country, that think that we can do things in a much more creative and different way, as you all were saying, as Judith, you started talking about. And so in this audience here, I think we have a number of people who are representatives of the state and other people who are lobbyists in the state talking about this educational issues. How do you take this conversation and turn it into something that people who make our laws and create this policy can chew on to change things, that isn't just down the path of testing and, of course, all the lobbying from the testing companies that go into getting us more tests? But how do you take that conversation to this pragmatic level in a place like this?
Well, I think one thing to do, I mean, there's a couple of things. First of all, what do you really want schools to do? I mean, we've mentioned the engagement and the caring side. We've mentioned the resources. We've mentioned the quality of teachers. We've mentioned arts and phys ed and civic engagement. Lots of stuff that people want from their schools. This has been studied. So how do you make sure that schools actually provide that? So that gets you into the, if you want it, no, so one, you have to fund it. Two, you have to make sure it's done well. And then are the outcomes what you want? But some of that is having different factors in your quote-unquote accountability matrix. And you'll hear more of that, I think, in the next panel. Julian is more of an expert on that than I am. And California has taken some important steps in that direction. Even within the question of what have kids learned, I gave you the New York Performance Standards. There's thousands of kids in those schools now. They are larger than the great majority of high school districts in this country. You probably don't have to, well, you're countywide, so you got some big ones. But there's a lot of schools there. And so doing a very different kind of assessment is certainly very possible. The state of New Hampshire has gotten a waiver from the Federal Ed Department to design a different state assessment system. So theirs is, they're going to administer the Smarter Balanced, which is like the PARC, only in three grades, elementary, middle, and high school. And the rest of it is going to be performance tasks at some locally made and some state tasks. I don't really know the mix. But the point is they are redesigning it. The new federal law, ESSA, will allow up to 7 states to start doing that, and 3 years down the road would open the door potentially to any state that wanted to do it. So you can begin to think, okay, one, what are the other things we need to know that our schools are doing, and how do we find out? And two, we want our kids to learn and be prepared academically. How do we find out what that is without, you know, in effect, destroying the school to find out about how it's doing? So there's a whole set of other, there was a bunch of work done in the 1990s, interesting work on portfolios and performance assessment and gathering. The state of Nebraska had a whole program that was largely killed by No Child Left Behind, as were most of the innovations. They're going to have to go back in time. But there's other stuff that continues in addition to the consortium. So we can begin to look at examples. And so I would say if you're a legislator or you're lobbying the legislature, go find out those examples that can meet what we know in general people want from the schools, not just a narrow slice.
I'm going to take a little different piece and talk about the corporate takeover of public education. It's coming to a state near us. You know, from an organization that, you know, we have been in, you know, we filed a Title VI complaint, which is a civil rights complaint against the school closures in Chicago, where you may have heard about a hunger strike that was done by our clients. Over Diet High School closing. We also filed a complaint against Newark over the One Newark plan. And we also filed a complaint against New Orleans, which people may know was the, you know, that was like school closures on steroids and a takeover in under cover of night after Hurricane Katrina. Firing all the teachers, getting rid of the union. I mean, you name it, it happened. It's now basically an all-charter school system. And so what I would say is that we need to stop the corporate takeover of public education because therefore it won't be public any longer. And public education is really important to this country in fashioning citizens. It's not just about college and career ready. I think we've gotten a little off message on public education. It is not just about being a cog in a wheel and sorting people out so that some people work for $7 an hour, $7.50 an hour, and others make millions of dollars a year. We have to really think about accountability, that works, that allows for creativity in public schools. Unfortunately, in this like world of corporate takeovers, Democrats and Republicans are on the same side with each other. They might call it something different, but the reformers are the reformers, and they're taking over public education. And so we have to, as a state, I am hoping, because I am a citizen of this state and a resident of this state, that we really do look at slowing down charters, because charters don't have accountability. We don't look at their data. We have no idea what they're doing on suspensions and expulsions. What we do is we say we need something better, so let's close down a school, let's open a charter, and then give them all kinds of latitude. And children can get into a charter sometimes if they can figure out the system of how to get in, but they can get kicked out very quickly because those schools, yet they, although they take public dollars, don't feel that they have to actually educate every child, especially special education children. And so we as a state have to say no to the corporate takeover of education, and that includes looking at our budgets to see how much money we're putting into this testing system. As you said, I mean, it is amazing. My daughter's school, we didn't have computers until it was time for Park. Children couldn't get their hands on technology, but we figured out how to make it happen when it was time to test children. Yet a child, I remember when my daughter was in first grade in Fairfax County, a colleague of mine said her son, who was six, and my daughter was six at the time, her son was making a presentation on a smart board in his classroom. And I said to her, a smart board? We don't have one smart board in my whole school. They had a smart board in every classroom. So that gap started at six. And just like math, it is cumulative. And so the idea that we will instead go to a charter system where we will have an open gap, where schools are operating privately, and when we're taking money to compete against ourselves, and to put money into things that are all about the tests that get back into private pockets, we have a problem. We have an addiction to corporate takeover of every public system and government system that we have. And so I'm hoping in the state of Maryland that we will say no to corporate takeover of education. So,
I don't know. I think when we talk this idea of accountability, you know, I feel like, you know, I have worked in management consulting before, and all the terms like optimize and leverage, and they get thrown around. But when I talk to public educators, I feel like there's some sort of Kool-Aid that's been consumed with words like accountability and rigor and, you know, authentic teaching. And I'm like, just teach the kids and stop using these words. But, you know, when we talk about really what good public education looks like, it looks like the kind of education that parents do at home with their kids, and they know where their kids are. It's individual growth. It's measured child by child. It's not measured classroom by classroom or even school by school. And when we have this competition, this where federal accountability standards have pushed down to state accountability standards, and superintendents and principals know darn well that they have good schools because they have good people working in them, and they're not able to focus on things like getting families involved at the local level because they're focused on other things. I think really concretely it's pushing back. Now that we have ESSA, I don't know that states quite know what they're going to do. And we have got some legislators in the back of the room that I'm sure are a little worried about trying to figure that out. But taking this opportunity to take a pause and say, locally, let's take this pause and let's get back some of that accountability and define it here in whatever county or jurisdiction you're in, before the state or the federal government comes in and defines it. So we're out of this rat race a little bit.
So you mentioned ESSA. You mentioned the Every Student Succeeds Act that's taking over No Child Left Behind and it's coming to our state and a state near you. So what are its implications? What are its implications for the state of Maryland? What's implications for how it's going to alter this debate taking place that will be taking place in legislatures here and elsewhere?
Well, quickly, the state still has to test in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school reading and math and 3 grades in science, same as before. That hasn't changed. What's changed is the accountability piece, so that the adequate yearly progress is gone, the feds are very clear that the waiver provision that you have to judge teachers and other educators by student test scores, that's not a federal requirement. So it's entirely up to the state. You have to get data on all the schools. You don't have to set up a multi-tier evaluation system. You just have to identify the lowest scoring 5% of the schools. The lowest scoring will be a preponderance still of test scores, but it can involve other factors. Once a school is in that 5%, the school and the district have to figure out what to do for the first 3 years, and the state is only required to intervene after 3 years, and that can be technical assistance or it could be something stronger. So with that picture you see, you really could revamp a whole lot about the accountability. Once you do that, the push to test all the kids all the time can go away. You don't need all those interim benchmark tests. The districts can drop them. They have in some places already eliminated them entirely and left it back to the teachers. Now, if you're in those lower scoring 5%, there's a real danger, or somewhere near that, that in fact the pressure will be on to boost the test scores to get out from that. And so it's the kids, those kids, who are going to be overwhelmingly kids of color and low income, they're going to have their brains tested out still. That's a real serious danger that we have to pay attention to and figure out a different way to make sure that those schools improve. First of all, find out if they've got the resources they need, whether they're using them well, then investigate what particular things may be going on that can be improved and getting away from the test prep stuff. So there's a big space. One other useful space, I mentioned New Hampshire got a waiver. That's under No Child Left Behind. Arne Duncan gave it to them. But in the new law, 7 states can do things like New Hampshire's doing. That is to rely preponderantly on local assessments. That means a redesigned system in which you only use the state tests in a few grades. Perhaps you could even try to do sampling. That makes much more sense, but that might not be permissible. But at a minimum, just 3 grades, and then use other assessments that are, in fact, designed by the teachers and are useful for helping improve instruction and to let people know where kids are at on a much wider range of things. So that the school gets much more information about the school as a whole, not just the outcomes, and on the academic outcomes, you can dig into much richer ones. So that's all possible. I want to end with a caution, kind of in the corporate takeover line. There's a bunch of corporations out there looking to sell you performance tasks on the computer that they will then profit from, and there will be no more engaging or interesting or teacher-controlled than the regular standardized tests. They're talking formative assessments. I read 2 versions of the same thing, quote from the same thing from New York State this morning, in which this program will assess the kids every 5 minutes. Can you imagine that? You don't even have time to think about what you're doing and you're taking a test about it, a mini test, embedded assessment, they're going to call it. So really necessary to beware this stuff, because what's critical here is to have skilled professionals, real teachers, having the fundamental say in making sure the teacher goes on. Yeah, we want to modify. There was a president who's a long way from my favorite president who used the words trust but verify. In this case, that's a reasonable thing to do. The question is, how do we verify without killing the trust and killing the teaching itself? I tried to give you an example with the New York Consortium. There's others out there where that can be done. And I think if you think about it, you can conjure up ways to do it and then go get permission from the feds, which you will need to do.
I just would like us to not, I think the language about ESSA replacing No Child Left Behind, I'd like to get away from that and just look at this ideally, if we can all, you know, pull up the morale a little bit as an opportunity. I would certainly love to see more than 7 states be allowed to do a pilot program or whatever they're calling it, whereby which they can use local assessments. And to be clear, we had a really, really exceptional student panel. I think only 1 student on that panel had actually taken PARC, but had all watched their colleagues or looked at PARC questions. And this idea of accountability is never going to change unless we change it as local as possible. But also, the accountability itself, as we all know, is a sham. And I use that word a lot, because when you look at the sort of standardization that was supposed to happen across this country, it hasn't happened, because the states that still are PARC users all have different cut scores. And so the states got their scores and probably said, oh, you know what, at this point, they were bad, right? And they're particularly bad for students of color across the poverty line. So all those achievement gap things are all 10 times worse with Park. And so states invented their own cut scores. And so it's basically a curve. And so if there is to be comparing Maryland to Michigan to California, you can't do it. And so why not let our local educators, let our states and on down design assessments that are really tailored to their curriculum, where assessment can be measured child by child, or progress can be measured child by child.
So there's a question here that is, if the New York assessment system program is working, why isn't it being scaled up everywhere? And you can say that about programs. I think you could look at, there are programs in Baltimore City that are doing great work. Why isn't it being scaled up? And that's always universal chances, I think.
Well, the biggest single issue is simply the state has committed itself to high-stakes standardized testing primarily. These schools were set up under a commissioner long ago who was very supportive of this. The next commissioner tried to kill him. And this thing was fought through the legislature and the State Board of Ed, called the Regents, for eight years or so. And they organized so effectively with their parents and communities that the assembly, the House, in effect, was ready to pass a law. And the head of the House, who has since been indicted and is going to jail, but anyway, he was trying to block this, but finally he gave in. He went to the regions and said, if you don't okay this, they're going to pass laws. Now, the assembly essentially appoints the regents, and they don't want, therefore, to intervene with those whom they've appointed. Crazy politics of that particular state. The end result was they told the regents you got to do it. Now, what's interesting is they have done so well that the regents have allowed them to expand twice since that happened, now up to 38. But that's still that's 20,000 high school students in a city with 150,000, 200,000 high school students. So it's still a small sliver. There are lots of districts in New York, I'd say probably a lot more in the suburbs, who actually would love to do something like this but haven't been able to get an okay to do it. So it is political. That is the essence of the story. It's not the money, because the New York Consortium schools don't get any extra money. They could use it well, and they should get it, but they don't now have it. So I think the political side, then the second is, and it is important, this is not simple work to make this transition. These are teachers committed to doing it and working hard to do it. Not all teachers are going to want to do it. I'm not arguing this is the only method by which one could do it differently. In fact, the question then becomes, we don't need one system. We need a system of systems so that you can have variety, so that counties in Maryland wouldn't have to all be on identical. They can do some very light testing as a dipstick, no stakes attached, to help correlate how things are going, and investigate as needed. So the transition time will take time. You've got a lot of teachers now that have been teaching under no system except one that's controlled by testing. They're going to have to learn to do it differently. Some of them may not want to be truthful. So there's a learning curve here. The students are not used to this stuff. When they go into the New York Consortium High Schools, these students have been to regular schools, and they don't know how to think. They don't know how to write. They don't know how to have a conversation about academic material. They have to learn all that in high school. And because some of them do, of course, know, but many of them do not. So the students themselves are going to have to transition. The parents are going to have to be educated about this. So it's a complicated story. But if we don't go down that road, I always ask, if in 1994, when the federal law changed away from norm reference testing, and we opened the door, as began to happen in some states, to doing it differently, and that's fundamentally about the quality of the teaching profession and then the organizing of schools. If we had done it differently, we'd be in a real, real different place than we are right now. So sooner or later, if we want high-quality schools, we got to say, okay, let's start really thinking about what those look like and how to get them. And it's a political problem, it is a resource problem, and it's a problem about ensuring a steady transition.
There's a question here, because it is a political question. We live in the United States, and these battles were fought out in our state legislatures, or they're fought out with our feet. You were talking about your question about where your daughter is going to go. I mean, I think all of us have gone through that. I mean, I went through that with my oldest kids. One got to the Baltimore School for the Arts. Thank you. So she was safe. The other one was to be stuck somewhere else. So no, We put her in private school. The young woman went through an IB program, and she made it out very successfully and is doing really well. But, I mean, we're put in this position. Poor working class families were also put in this position because they struggled to put their kids into the Catholic school around the corner from where they live to make sure the kid's going to be in a school where they're safe. This happens every day. So, again, going back to policy. So you have, a little bit further in terms of policy, things have to change drastically, which means you have to create a conversation inside this state's legislature, since we're sitting in Maryland, about what the future is going to be. ESSA might give us the opportunity to open doors that didn't exist. Not that I think that it's, you know, the work of God is going to come down and make all schools good, but I think, Judith, this is part of, there's an opportunity here to use this to create a different discussion.
Right. I think that gets back to the first point I made, which is about public will.
Right.
And are we really ready to have a system of education that educates all children and provides high-quality education? And I think one of the things that strikes me about education discussions is that public education is the one place where we don't ask the consumer how they feel. So students who are on the receiving end usually do not get asked, how's it going? What are you learning? How are you feeling about what you're learning? It's like Starbucks, Walmart, KFC, McDonald's. They ask the consumer. Mm-hmm. When it comes to education, we really don't. We might have school climate surveys, and that's, you know, but that glosses over a real discussion about education. We also don't really get teachers too involved because it's too political to get the unions involved. Well, teachers are the ones in the classroom actually understanding how this is playing out. And so I think that if we as a state are going to do something different, we need to talk to the people who are involved, not to the big money interests, not to the Zuckerbergs, not to the person who says, I've got $10 million to save public education, or the corporation who's going to say, and I can be paid $10 million to save education. We've got to talk to the people involved in the system and have some real tough conversations about what's working, what's not working. How do we update education? We need to hear from young people about that. How do we update education? A lot of the work that we do around school discipline, we start with young people. What's going on in your school? What's the climate like? And we find out that the climate's like a jail, that they don't feel like anybody cares about them, right? And you start a conversation there and can build up. So this has got to be about public will. The problem also with public will is that because we have lost a lot of parents to the private schools, right, they don't see themselves vested, right? If I can opt out with my money, then what do I care about what happens to those other kids, because it's not my kid and I don't care about them, and by the way, I need somebody to work at McDonald's anyway, right? And so part of this has got to be that we have got to see ourselves as a future of people together, where we're all invested in the education of young people.
I'll just add, I think, you know, involving students and parents is huge. And I think these big policy conversations always sound so big and scary and impossible until you realize that those conversations happen in schools and they happen in communities every day. People don't know they're doing it, but when you really are talking about best practices, you know, one of the things that I was so intrigued by when I learned about it in Frederick County, and in every county in the state of Maryland has one, it's a Judy Center. It was named for Judy Hoyer, Steny Hoyer's wife. And we have this amazing best practice that it's working all across the state of Maryland, where with just a little bit of state money, we are getting, through engaging families, we're taking kids 0 through 5, looking at the whole child and the whole family, a little bit of state money and some county money too, integrating the public library system, integrating social services in the public school system, and we're getting these kids ready for kindergarten. And when you track the achievement of these kids through elementary school, it's working. So we have best practices in the state, like the Judy Center, that are absolutely working. But there's public will, there's money, and there's the fact that I think that so many of our educators don't even have time to stop and think about what's working and what's not working, because it's on to the next assessment or it's on to the next curriculum change that's aligned with the national whatever. That, you know, process improvement, no matter if you're talking about a school system or if you're talking about the assembly line at General Motors, there's, you have to have the points at which you reflect. And when there's constant reform, there's not time for that reflection. And I'm really hopeful, and I may be misguided, that this ESSA, whatever this confusion is about how we're going to implement ESSA at the state level or how ESSA is going to be implemented, is a time for everybody to have that reflection and have those important conversations, both nationally about pushing back against these corporate reformers and then locally about where we can actually say, what do we really want to do and what do we want our school district to look like, and use our best practices.
So the panel's about out now, time-wise anyway, and I'd like to kind of conclude these thoughts. We had somebody wrote in here about following the money and who benefits and gains from all of this testing financially, socially, and politically, and I think we've touched on that a little bit in this conversation about the powers there. But I'm curious, as we end this, to talk about, the question of accountability, which we always talk about, which doesn't, that we have a hard time dealing with a question sometimes, and how do you ensure that concrete learning is going on? So in your closing thoughts here, how do we do that?
Well, I tried to answer that with examples on that, like the New York Consortium. There's other out there. Our website has some of that on. There's other stuff. The consortium is not the only place in the country doing it. It's just, in a sense, the largest and I think in many ways the most successful, given the student population that it works with. So I think there are ways of assuring, the issue comes up of comparability, like how do you know that the kid in Baltimore is doing as well as the kid in Montgomery County in one of the wealthier schools, for example. And, you know, we'll use a test score to tell us, and then, of course, the question, and even if the test is accurate, which it may or may not be, what do you then do is the unanswered question, and never mind when you're focused on the test, what you don't do, and what all the negative feedback, backwash is. So you can do it with the sampling and produce school-level data to tell you whether kids are doing similar ways, and then put the test aside and really think about what is it, instruction, curriculum, resources, professional development for teachers, the school climate, the student engagement, and the assessment. What are the things we can do to make a school and system that all the kids are engaged in and that all the kids seriously benefit from in a way that brings us significantly closer to equity? Because while schools can't be a solution to poverty and inequity, they're a part of the solution, and it's a part we need to work on.
So I would just add that I think that, you know, I would suggest that people who are in Annapolis and who are going to be looking at how to implement ESSA take some time to go to some schools. You know, seeing is really important. Experiencing some classrooms, going to different schools, it is an eye-opener. Go to schools in your county, go to schools in another county. Go to the consortium schools. When I talked about public will, I think part of the problem is that if your child goes to a well-resourced school with great teachers, you have no clue of what's going on in the under-resourced schools, and vice versa. You ask a child or a parent in an under-resourced school what would they want for their child, they can't even imagine. They can't even dream about it because they haven't seen it. They don't know it exists. And so I think part of what we have to do is we're moving forward towards, you know, coming up with new state law. I know from our perspective at the, you know, we do work in the states, but one of the things we've always been clear about is that the federal government should have a role in monitoring what happens to education. We've come a long way. The feds have always been important
in ensuring equity and getting rid of racial discrimination and ending segregation. And so for the feds to take a step back is very scary for those of us who do civil rights work. But I would suggest that we take the time to experience our schools. Talk to the people in the schools, sit through some classes, just walk around. If you walk around, you will see inequity firsthand. I promise you. You can come into my district, I'll tell you 5-10 schools where you will see things that you don't expect to see in a public school because of disinvestment over a period of time. And so I would just suggest that we do that and have those conversations before we start to go do something that will send us down the wrong path again, because we've been on the wrong path for a long time. That so-called miracle from Houston that we all bought into around testing and how great what was happening in Texas, we bought into a pipe dream. And so now we have the chance to correct it.
I guess when I think about No Child Left Behind and I think about accountability, I think the only thing that I think is good that came out of No Child Left Behind was the fact that for once, school districts and counties across the country had to actually write down how their kids did, and they had to sort it by race, they had to sort it by number of students who live in poverty, they had to sort it by English language status and by special education status. And so the writing was there. And so since No Child Left Behind, and even before that, you know, this race to fix it, right, to correct the gaps. But the gaps have just gotten worse. And so we know none of that has worked. And what's increased, of course, poverty has increased. And this resource issue is certainly part of that. But, you know, absolutely, school districts, you know, I don't even want to say the word, but there needs to be accountability. But when teachers have the opportunity to work with students in their classrooms and there is a curriculum that's aligned with the local assessments those kids are taking, you have the baseline data that can be measured. What's the problem is when that data is interrupted by yet another reform and you never have a baseline and you never know what's going on. It doesn't need to be one experiment after another because you never have a control group. And so you have good best practices, you have the community and the public will, and you've got local elected officials and state elected officials who are going to stand the line and say, you know what, stop interrupting our good work while it's still in progress. Yes, we may need a couple of years to have the data that you want, but we're getting it and we're working on it. And I think that's part of that collective will.
I thank the panel here. It's been a great panel, I think. Liz Barrett, Judith Brown, Dianis, Martin Newell. I also want to thank the Maryland State Education Association for convening such an important panel on this issue. Please take a minute to tweet me, at Mark Steiner, with your thoughts, or email me at talk@steinershow.org. It's time for another quick break, but when we come back, you'll hear my interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his new book, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction, Between the World and Me.